The following program was produced by Clock Tower Radio, clocktower.org, and is broadcast in partnership with Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM.
Coming up next, a program celebrating the life and work of the artist and musician Conrad Schnitzler, featuring music from across four decades and a conversation with his longtime friend and collaborator, Jen Ken Montgomery.
This is David Weinstein for the radio station of the Clock Tower Gallery. Here we come up on July of 2012, and there is an anniversary approaching, and that is the passing of Conrad Schnitzler, the legendary composer, musician, and audio adventurer, who died in August of 2011. And today in the studio, I have one of his friends and colleagues and collaborators. Jen Ken Montgomery joins us in the Clock Tower. Welcome, sir.
Hello. Thank you.
Why don't we give people a little background into when he emerged and he's associated with things like Tangerine Dream.
Cluster, of course.
Cluster, with a K.
With a K. I mean, he's collaborated with so many people over the years. Yeah. He never really wanted to stay in any
group. He didn't seem to stay.
No. He was involved with... I'm learning more about him now in the earliest periods when he was really in the art world.
Yeah.
And, you know, collaborating with very well-known artists, Fluxus. He was certainly in the Fluxus group, never connected to the word Fluxus or to any name of any art group. So the same thing with the bands. He was only with Tangerine Dream very shortly.
Yeah.
He was
on 69,
their first album.
Yeah. And this was the krautrock emergence, which is a word I don't really like very much, but he wasn't a main player in that.
Absolutely pivotal
moment.
In fact, you know, I've known Conrad since 1981. There are so many things about his early history that I didn't know, even though I spent a lot of time with him in Berlin. He's not one to, talk about his accomplishments, but it was many years after that I was speaking with a friend of one of the people that was producing records for him in Paris, Serge Leroy, who really interviewed and grilled Conrad about all kinds of stuff. And he suddenly called me up from Paris one night on the phone and just said, "Do you know that Conrad started the Zodiac Club?" Now, the Zodiac Club is well known in the Berlin German electronic music scene as the place where Amandul, Tangerine Dream, Can, Cluster, all these musicians from that period in the late 60s were just coming together and jamming and playing. It was a black, totally everything painted black, the windows, the floors, the ceilings, all this kind of stuff. And Conrad said he just wanted to have a place where he could make noise and just invite anybody to come and do anything and all that kind of stuff. So he was involved in this very, very early core scene. In a really big way. So it was very chaotic and kind of crazy. So when he started amplifying a cello, I think, in the beginning, and then, before he had a synthesizer, it was just making as much noise as you could. And so he would jam with bands that, like a psychedelic rock band like Tangerine Dream, but then he'd bring all this noise and chaos into it, which really went kind of against what Tangerine Dream was doing, but it made this explosive sound, which is recorded, luckily, on their first album. If you go back further, it's also, I'm actually even learning more now as after he's passed, as I've really taken an interest into looking at his what he was doing when he was very young, when he met Joseph Beuys in Dusseldorf, and then became his first student there. He was temporarily, for 1 year, he was a sailor on a ship and was on port in Dusseldorf, met Joseph Beuys at a bar. They became friends, and it goes and said, "Well, why don't you study art?" And so he started at the academy there. Conrad of Ghent's always moving along, so he didn't stay very long. And but that's when he began really doing like happening kinds of things. And in the early days, it was very, from what I understand, really crazy, chaotic things. I mean, he had pots with microphones under them that he was throwing stones in, and there was no instruments. It was all kinds of, you know, face painting and body art, kind of messy kinds of things.
Thank you.
the early, in fact, the cluster was, it's a reference to sound. So when he began doing events, he would call them cluster. It was just like a sound cluster. And he referred to his, what he did as Geräusch, which is noise. And cluster with the K was not a fixed group at all, but it was actually just whatever noise and chaos of people coming together. And in that sense, Conrad says that cluster never ended. Cluster always stayed. So he did have many configurations of cluster with a K over the years. But when the two of the players from cluster began doing work, they called themselves cluster with a C, which we've all gotten to know. But I think it was Rodelius and Conrad in the very earliest period that played together. But again, it was very different than what we think of today as like playing together and, oh, we're a group and we're a band. It was really more this kind of collective scene of artists coming and making noise. So, yeah, so it was late 60s when these music happening things were happening. Tangerine Dream, early 70s, Eruption with Wolfgang Seidel, who's a good friend of his and a friend of mine in Berlin now, who... This was still coming out of the art world. You know, I know his musical influences were Jimi Hendrix, Miles Davis, and this kind of period in the 60s and the late 50s. What I'm finding as I go through his archives of films and videos, which I've that I have gotten, there's just hours and hours of stuff that I had never seen before in art galleries. What we'd today call sound installations, really, or happening sound installations with cassette players hanging from ceilings, spinning around, radios on the wall being tuned to different
human
sounds.
Beings wearing tape recorders,
right? Playing violins, all kinds of crazy things, and they're just these long, ongoing, you know, not really concerts at all, more like just sort of happening performances, things happening. He's there painting his face. You know, doing things, running through the streets with microphones, all kinds of happening things. But they were connected to galleries and in the art world, and increasingly moving away from the institutions into the streets. Thank you. found a catalog of work by the Goethe House presented in New York in the 70s of Berlin artists, and you went through there and saw all the resumes of all the artists that were there, and you know, Conrad's was really stood out as being radical and just kind of like, he was like, art is no secret anymore. And it was like, I do this, I do that, I do it in the street, I do it everywhere. Mm-hmm. It was very, you know, non-academic kind of approach to this kind of scene. And so he moved away from that. And I think it was the sound and the music that really, he was doing sculpture. I don't know if that's another thing that's not so well known about him, but mm-hmm. He studied sculpture with boys and he exhibited large metal sculptures. But one day he told me that he had a, it was with Erwin Schmidt from Cannes, that they were talking about music. And I guess Kahn really, you know, wanted to make music on some level, but never had learned music. And I think it was Erwin Schmidt that first told him, oh, well, just you can just make music with anything kind of thing. And Conrad took all his sculptures into a field and just left them, and just decided that he wanted to sculpt with sound. And that's really was the beginning of him just totally focused on constructing, composing with sound. It's interesting to talk about the transition from the 70s to the 80s. I met him in 1981. So I'd say in the late 70s, he was getting frustrated with the art world and also with the music industry world. He really wanted to do things on his own. This is the big period where he began self-producing, making his own album covers, and becoming what would be a reclusive period in his life, mm-hmm. which was right around the time that I met him. You know, his music really stood out to me from the other music that I was listening to at the time, and his address was on the back of one of his records, and I wrote to him, and he wrote to me back, and we got into a correspondence immediately. So I was performing in a band at the time, and we were in Berlin. And so while I was there, I sent him a postcard, and he invited me over for tea. And so, and it was an image that I will never forget, going to Conrad Schnitzler's house in 1981 in Berlin. There was, when I walked in, everything was painted black. The curtains on the windows were black. The floor was black. The furniture was black. The ceiling was black. Everything was black, except Kahn himself, who wore white pants, a white shirt, and a white jacket, and a white leather jacket, like a motorcycle jacket. I mean, it was just like, you know, this magical guy. Well, again, and the direct relationship with your audience and your listeners, which is, I think, is what Conrad wanted to do. His street performances were very much about, you know, having direct contact with people. And when he entered this reclusive period, it was really by post that he stayed in touch with people. Mm. And people would write to him, and they heard his music. They liked it. And he very much liked that personal connection. And so, the cassette, international cassette movement and international correspondence and mail art that really flourished in the 80s, mm-hmm. you know, had its seeds, I think, in the 70s with this kind of spirited person mm-hmm. That Con had of wanting to connect in this way and be free. You know, he always wanted to be free. He wanted to be free from groups, from names, from political, from religion, from, you know, just everything. And he wanted his music to be free, which is why he made these individual tracks that could be mixed together in different ways. He wanted to actually free the sounds up. I mean, it was really very much about freedom. And despite having records released on major record labels, Conrad never signed a contract, which was to his monetary, definitely.
Yeah, I was going to say, did he have money?
No, he was always struggling and doing odd jobs and trying to survive one way or the other. No, well, he did actually.
He didn't want to go into the university system.
He didn't. Not the academic, but he did teach. There's an album that he produced with his students in Hamburg, but it was not a full time job. It was maybe he was a visiting artist teaching that kind of thing. He was great with people and would have been a wonderful teacher, but he did all kinds of things, and he was happiest when he did the simplest things. Towards the late 70s, I believe, he was he called himself a janitor, but I think he was taking care of the house and maybe getting cheaper rent or free rent or something to take care of this building. And so he would sweep the floors and, you know, take care of it. But then later in the 80s, when he had a very cheap living situation, and he had also his wife, who was a music teacher, who he met around that time, was also helping to just, you know, pay the bills and kind of keep things very minimal for him. Hmm. So then his goal was to try to he actually earned money, amazingly enough, very small amounts of money, but by selling his music directly, you know, for a few dollars he'd sell cassettes to people who would send it to him. But his relationship with record companies and whatnot was, okay, it's great, you want to make a record for me? Fantastic, here. Here's some music, make it. If you make money, give me some money back. And so that's how he built relationships and how he lost relationships. Mm-hmm. And usually with companies, he lost relationships because they would not, of course, reciprocate in any ways. But there were individuals in the world that really loved his music, were really passionate about it. And if they did make some little money, they would give it back to him. More often, they would lose money. And this was one of Con's greatest fears when somebody would approach him, somebody like me or somebody who was really passionate about his music. They'd say, well, I'm really glad that you want to produce a record for me, but I don't want you to go broke.
Yeah.
So why don't you just put out a cassette or do something that's cheaper, you know?
Amazing.
Yeah. Thank you. Conrad was so meticulous about his music, and he kept accurate archives. He was German, you know, but half Italian. So he had this romantic, crazy side with this very kind of, you know, intellectual and orderly German side. And it made for this wonderful combination in it for such a poetic character as he was, that he, you know, was very, really in control of his music. And he had a numbering system and a dating system and, you know, very accurate. But his visual work, of which there was much, was just all just thrown into a closet, unlabeled, and in total chaos. So it's been taking, it took me a lot of time to sort through it and to begin to see what was all there. And my interest in that was that when I had, after I really got to know him, after spending some time in Berlin, when he moved from that black flat that I told you about, he actually moved to another flat, which is interesting in itself because I helped him move. In the new flat was on the top floor. He was down on the bottom of floor of this other building. Suddenly he moved to the top floor of another building in another neighborhood. Everything was white. The floors, the ceiling, the curtains, everything was white. And that's when he would wear his, he was changed to wearing black. So he was so consistent about his the black-white thing. I mean, as you, anybody who knows his music will and know that if you know that he had control over release, if you see a very simple black and white cover with his name, if it's a CD, large on the spine, you know, he had a certain aesthetic that he was very consistent about his entire life, this black-white thing. But anyway, so back to the videos. When he was moving to this other apartment, he let me stay in his old apartment. For a while there, I actually got to stay there with his equipment because he first moved his personal things and left the equipment there, and I actually got to record and play in his studio, which was, you know, looking back, I mean, what an unbelievable experience and luxury in my life at that time. I was pretty young, and it was 1985. I had no idea what, you know, what had befallen me, what luck had befallen me to have this opportunity, and I had access to his music. He had a cassette organ of 12 cassette players where you could play pieces that were for 12 cassettes to be played together. And I would just go through and play concerts of his. And I had an absolute revolution in my thinking about sound and about music and the possibilities. It had expanded beyond what I had been thinking in stereo, and suddenly it was this whole surround sound kind of environment of sound. That kind of connected my influences and ideas about what I'd read from John Cage growing up. Suddenly, it all kind of gelled. But during that time, he had a little stand with 8mm film projector and a big suitcase filled of reels, and you could just put them on and look at them, and this, and you could slow them and speed them up. And I spent a lot of time looking at his films and videos. And I had a lot of free time back then. It was just unbelievable. Can you imagine that? And but I remembered these and wanted to see them again. And I remember when I was at his place, maybe it was like 2003, I was asking about those films, and he had a suitcase of these films, and he just kind of ruffled through the suitcase, and he handed me a few of the films and said, "Here, you want them?" Whatever. But it was a big suitcase filled with them. And so I still have a couple of his films, actual films, but later on when I asked about that, during another move that he had, that suitcase he gave to a friend to keep for storage, it was in the basement, there was a flood in the basement, and apparently the whole thing got thrown out. But he had made video copies of these really crudely in the 70s and the early 80s, and he played music to them and sped them up and slowed them down and whatnot, and I now have access to digital files of all this material. He would set up little sets and stand inside them and act and perform and do things, and maybe somebody was holding the lights on it. They're all very simple. And then there's ones of him performing, and there's ones of meditations, of just visual, abstract, looking at light and color. Thank you. First of all, one of the things that Conrad loved to do was these long action radio programs, 10-hour, 12-hour radio programs, or 30-hour concerts, even from the early 60s when he did these happenings. Mm-hmm. One of the galleries, he did one that was, I forget, it was like 50 hours of continuous performing. Every day he'd go to the gallery for 8 hours and perform. And he made a limited edition box set where each cassette, where he recorded the entire 50 hours, and then I forget, it was 100 cassettes, each cassette 1 hour of the performance, original tape. So he liked these really long action kinds of things. He always wanted to do bigger and more.
We're living never in the past. We're living never in the future. We're always living, you and me, we're living in just the time we're living. And this means we're just picking up the sounds. We're living and nothing behind, nothing in front, and we don't care about the future and the past, and that's why we have nothing always left, you know.
Did he embrace new technology all the time?
Absolutely. He was always working with new technology, but on a very personal level of what he could afford to get his hands on, he was always getting the magazines that talk about the latest equipment and kind of drooling over what he wanted. He really liked his equipment. And
did he become a laptop guy in the end? Was it?
He had a laptop in the end, but a laptop with an array of analog and digital equipment all around him connected to that laptop. So he was never the kind of laptop artist that the younger generation is. He used it more as his mixing board, kind of. But when I was with him in the middle 80s, he had a computer. And the first computer music that I did was in Berlin in his studio. And, I mean, it's just, it was the Yamaha CX-5M computer, which had four lines on it and a green, the green screen. And, you could plug in these little things, notes.
What you haven't said is Con Mythology. With a dash. And you've created a website.
Yes, because after the gallery exhibition idea came up, it actually first it was just an idea to do something about Conrad. We didn't know what it was going to be, but he was interested in doing something to coincide with the film screenings. Mm-hmm. And then at Harvest Works, Carol Parkinson had already last March had invited me to do some multi-channel sound works of Conrad's there, and it went over real. I mean, it was just beautiful to hear these. It was the first cassette concert. Cassette concerts are what Conrad created beginning in the 70s. They were concerts that were designed to be played through multiple cassette players, and they have an identifiable. You can tell what the sound, what it is. It's not random improvisation, but they don't have to start and sync in the same way. And there's just infinite room for variation in the way that you mix them with volumes and with how you start and stop them. And he was even open to adding other sounds or doing it in different. Actually, part of it was that he knew that you could never control your sound environment, so you may do it in completely different environments and have it sound totally different.
Thank you.
even some of his works, which are well known on albums or on CD, when you hear them, the way that he actually composed them and the way he listened to them in his studio in this with eight speakers surrounding you, it's a real physical experience, and it becomes apparent that his work as a sculptor was so important in his composition. And, you know, now multi-channel work is something, and sound art, multi-channel work is something we all have a vocabulary and we can talk about, speaking is about his work.
The website you created is
con-mythology.com.
Right.
And I will put a, I haven't done it yet, but I'm going to put a link page on that site that takes you to these other people in the world who have really good sites with interviews and with videos, with various things. Many of these videos actually are now on YouTube. They weren't while he was alive, but he gave permission to put them on YouTube.
Yeah, I found a bunch of them.
And unfortunately, the quality is just so terrible to see them on YouTube. It's going to be really exciting to see them projected.
Yeah. This is David Weinstein with Jen Ken Montgomery. We're talking about Conrad Schnitzler. Thank you, Ken, for coming in.
Thank you.
You can learn more about Ken's project at con-mythology.com. So we're signing off. Thanks, Ken, again. Everybody, this is David Weinstein for the radio station of the Clock Tower Gallery.
You were just listening to a program celebrating the life and work of the artist and musician Conrad Schnitzler, featuring music from across four decades and a conversation with his longtime friend and collaborator, Jen Ken Montgomery.
The previous program was produced by Clock Tower Radio, clocktower.org, and is broadcast in partnership with Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM.